It is 7:35. You're listening to 100.5 FM. Good morning. I'm Ray Richardson. Thanks for joining us. We're broadcasting live from the RowAutoGroup.com studio. Don't forget, our McVetty's Hearth and Home text line is 207-409-6172. You can find out more at stovesofmaine.com. David Jones is in the house along with Didi Richardson. Dr. Peter Earle, economist with the American Institute for Economic Research, and a whole bunch of other titles now that will take too long to get into, but certainly well-deserved. Doc, thanks for hanging around.
Sure thing.
So as we went to break, I was asking you, what sector of manufacturing would we most benefit from if we got it back on our soil?
So I think, I'll give you a choice. Do you want the quickest turnaround, like something we could get going really quickly, or the one that would have the most impact economically?
I
can tell you both.
Why don't you tell us both? But I'm really looking for what is the long-term sustainable economic benefit. That's what I'm really looking for.
Okay, so if we wanted to get industry really sort of grinding back in the U.S. quickly, the quickest place would probably be in textiles, right? We could probably get a turnaround in textiles in about a year in the Carolinas and in the northern portion of the South. If we wanted to talk about, you know, really long-term growth, I would say four areas, right? Automotive, right? Cars, heavy industry, steel, and defense, right? And that would be one of the reasons why I think that could be, I mean, first of all, there's a never-ending demand for cars and for industry. So, I mean, that's a road to the future. But we already have a lot of legacy expertise in steel and those sorts of things. And there's a lot of old plants that could be retooled. It might take a few years. You know, automakers have already shown, BMW, Volkswagen, Toyota, Tesla, that U.S. factories work for them. We're talking there about Tennessee, Georgia, those areas. So if we were to find out what exactly is the barrier, right, what would draw more car companies to the U.S., that would be a way not only to bring about a manufacturing turnaround or you know, a boost to manufacturing as it is, but also for the future. So I would say automotive in the medium term, in the short term, textiles, things like that.
Mm. Okay. And from an economic standpoint, if we were to robustly do that, what would that do to our GDP? What would that do to our tax base? And what would it do for wages in the country from your perspective?
I mean, all of that would be improved, right? We're making more things. We're selling them abroad, all that sort of thing. That's a good thing for all of us. It would also have a social effect. And one of the social effects it would have would be, you know, it shouldn't be lost on anyone that a lot of the deaths due to fentanyl and the opiates and all that stuff came in communities where over the last 30 years industry just left in the sort of wasteland.
Yeah.
So not only would we have that sort of growth and the more jobs and all that sort of thing, but we also would improve basically the standard of living in those areas, and we would probably in the process save tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of lives.
Which would be extraordinary. And I think we're going to do that to some degree anyhow with closing the border and stopping the flow of fentanyl.
I think so too, yeah.
But you're absolutely right. What's the old saying? Idle hands are the work of the devil or something to that effect.
Yeah, true. You know, I mean, people, they don't have a job. They have, you know, they just have nothing to do. And what do? They get into alcohol and drugs. That's bottom line.
Absolutely.
And it's a shame.
Because, well, we know.
And they have talent. Everybody has a talent.
Of course. God gave everybody talent. And, you know, sometimes it's hard to find, and took me a long time to find what mine was, which was sitting on my butt and talking in a mic.
I definitely think that the road to the future through textiles and through steel and through auto industries, that sort of thing, is a way better way than this attempt to create semiconductor foundries and compete with, say, Taiwan and other nations in places like Austin and Dallas, the long-term project. And that's a big part of what Biden was spending on. And I think we're going to find out that that was you know, maybe there's a national security component to it. Maybe there isn't. But the idea that the U.S. is going to become the next, that we're going to become the next chip supplier to the world, you know, that's a much longer term prospect. And also, I'm not sure that we can do it, you know, in a way that makes it effective cost-wise. We could make anything here. The question is, can we make it in a way that is marketable? Can we make it in a way that other people want to buy it versus what's already out there?
Well, that's the problem, because we compete with, for example, China, who don't have our labor laws, they don't have our benefit laws, they don't have, they don't care.
And that's exactly why I was saying, you know, what it would need to do to bring a lot of labor back here, or rather to bring the manufacturing back here, a lot of it has to do with labor, not with stuff, right? Not with building, you know, the facilities and all that stuff. It has to do with, you know, what people want and what they expect. I will say one thing really quickly, though. We're on a gold standard. Wages, right? Wages are indexed, and you don't have this kind of inflation. So that would already, right there, be good for labor, and that would help bring manufacturing back. If we stabilize prices and we make wages, you know, not erode so quickly due to purchasing power loss because of inflation.
You would think the unions would advocate for that for the very reason you just described, but they just don't seem
to
do that.
Why?
They have everything to gain from a more stable currency.
Yeah, there's no question that that's true. I agree. So what are we looking at here, you know, in terms of textiles? I know that's a broad term. Give us an idea of the micro look at textiles. What specifically are you talking about?
Clothing, shoes.
That covers everything from, as David just said, clothing, shoes, home goods, specialty fabrics.
Consumable items.
So we used to be a very robust maker of shoes here in the state of Maine.
Yep.
Of course,
absolutely.
Of course, the laws in the state of Maine went nuts and drove everybody out because we have wackadoodles that are running the government. They want to impose their will on everyone. But if we could create a much more hospitable environment here, do you see a place like Maine seeing a resumption of textiles?
I don't see why not.
It has the talent.
We have the talent.
You know,
here in Western Massachusetts, I mean, every river has old dead mills along it. Now that's
correct
technology,
sure.
But it's a sign
that
things could be done. Yeah, exactly.
You go down to Pawtucket, that's all mills. All right, buildings
exactly.
Everywhere.
But, yeah, right. And, sure.
And,
look at Maine. Maine is replete with it. Yeah,
any consumable item, you know, clothing, food. You know, those are the things I think. Like, what about farming? We import so much of our product here that we consume.
Yeah.
I mean, what about that industry where we're paying the farmers subsidies to not farm and then buying it from another country? Does that make sense?
Right. So, I mean, it doesn't. And that's what they would, I mean, so many, just like we were talking about before with the getting rid of the Fed and that sort of thing, or changing central bank. If you wanted to reform agriculture and make it very lean, you could. But there would be some pain in the meantime because there's all sorts of subsidies and there's sorts of, means built into it so that some people make some products and some others, and you're paying people not to farm and all that sort of thing. And, I'm not an agricultural economist, but I do know that it's rife with government interference, and it would take a little time to rationalize that and make it more act more like a business, like, say, you know, real estate or finance. Than the sort of very government networked business that it is right now.
Well, look, for example,
in the short term.
Look at dairy. So the USGA sets the wholesale milk price, and it's not enough to cover the cost of milking the cows and everything, and getting getting the milk to market. So places like Maine, so we subsidize dairy farmers here because the USGA sets the wholesale milk price way too low for farms to be able to make a living. I was thinking, it's funny you brought this up, or David or Doc or whoever brought it up. Matt Jacobson just joined us. Good morning.
Good morning, sir.
But I was thinking about the New Deal. We had President's Day yesterday, and a lot of people were saying they think FDR may have been the third most consequential president in American history. And I was thinking about the fact that the Commerce Department regulates under the Commerce Clause industry, and for example, regulates farming and that kind of thing. I think it was the Wickard case in 1937. Was that the case, Doc? I don't know if you remember, where the guy wanted to grow wheat to feed his own, or grow hay or whatever it was, to feed his own cattle, and they shut him down on it, saying it would affect the price of of wheat or whatever the product was, and I don't remember, but the point is that he couldn't even grow food for his own livestock because it might impact the price, you know, globally of that particular product. So they regulate the industry, and then because of the overregulation, they have to subsidize it for it to exist. It is among the most bizarre ideas in world history, but we don't even talk about this stuff.
Yeah, it has a lot to do with the interest groups, right? I mean, groups that go to Washington, D.C.,
lobbies,
and they negotiate certain... Right, exactly. It's all about lobbies. And, yeah, I mean, it's it would be better... I mean, you hate to make these choices. It would be better if we had a stronger but more self-reliant, agricultural sector in the U.S. But that's... I mean, there's a long list of things to change, and that's on it.
Yeah, it was Wickard versus Filburn from 42, which basically said that this guy could not grow food for his own livestock because
so they regulated
manipulate
it.
The price. Yeah, and they shut him down.
I mean, it's the regulations that are killing us. Bottom line, it's what it is.
That's exactly right. It's a big issue.
It kills everything. I don't care what industry it is.
It's true.
It's a one size fits all. Approach to business, which no business works like that.
So one size that doesn't fit all. Hey, I have a question around, we talk a lot about, outsourcing to other countries, and certainly that makes sense, competitive advantage and all the rest. But logistics cost and frankly, some of our adversaries, specifically China, require us to have unbelievable navy to keep the shipping lanes open and all that. And I wonder if there isn't an opportunity with raw materials in Canada, expertise in the United States, and cheaper labor in Mexico and maybe some of South America, that we couldn't eliminate a lot of logistics costs, probably a lot of sea lane costs, and still enjoy the same competitive advantage. What do you think of that idea?
Do you mean building lots and lots more ships, that sort of thing?
No. Building lots less ships, more railroads, using Mexico and Canada as opposed to Africa and China.
Yeah, I mean, two things. I mean, first, yes, we could certainly do that. The question is always going to come down to, is it cheaper to run that way than it is other ways, right? So, I mean, if it is, eventually the market will call for it. You wouldn't have to dictate it. You wouldn't have to mandate
right,
it.
Right, right.
The market will go in that direction. The second thing is, we could do a lot by getting rid of the Jones Act.
Absolutely.
Jones Act, yeah, that would be important.
Them Joneses, I'll tell you. All right.
That's right.
Always
causing
problems.
Yeah, I mean, so first of all, it's been a huge problem for the U.S.
Forever.
For shipping.
Yeah.
Second of all, if you hate the Yankees, the Steinbrenners were a shipbuilding factory. The Jones Act probably provided the wealth to build the Yankees into what we are. So
right.
That's another reason to get rid of the Jones Act if you don't like it.
I agree with you. You're absolutely right.
I want to catch you soon, so I'm...
I want to go back to this wheat case here very quickly, just because I brought it
of
up.
Of course.
And I want to give people the context of it. So Roscoe Filburn was an Ohio farmer who grew more wheat than was permitted by the Agricultural Adjustment Act of 1938. He argued that he could do this because the wheat never actually went to market. He did not sell it. He used it to feed his livestock, and therefore it couldn't be regulated by interstate commerce. But the Supreme Court ruled in favor of the government, stating that the cumulative effect of many farmers growing wheat for their own personal use could affect the national market. And I only brought that up because there's another good example of the overregulation of a product, and then because they've overregulated it, now they have to subsidize it so it can exist. This was a while ago. David Brinkley was alive. We all remember him. He used to do the Brinkley Report on ABC. Archer Daniels Midland did a survey, or whatever you want to call it, and they found that the breadbasket of America could literally feed the entire world if it was unleashed to do so.
Yeah, I've heard that.
So if that's the case, Doc, what do you think we have to do to get the overregulation of the farming industry out of here so that farms can survive and thrive?
Well, I mean, I think the first thing is that we've got to have them compete among themselves, right? I mean, we shouldn't romantically save farms. Farms should operate as a business on a competitive marketplace in the world, right? And if that means that some big ones survive and some small ones don't, that has to be fine with us. We have to be willing not to necessarily get everything we want. So that's the first thing. The second thing is...
Wait a minute. I want everything I want. Why shouldn't I have it? I'm an American.
Well, there we are. And that's why we have subsidized industries.
Right. No, I was kidding, of course. Dee Dee and I are not material people. We're just not into that. So, no, I get it.
We've got to be willing to have the chips fall where they may, and you know, remove the subsidies and that sort of thing. And also, you know, we've got to be willing to if there are any deals we have, the government has internationally saying we'll only grow this much soy if you only grow this much of that. We've got to eliminate those two. I mean, all the fetters have to be taken out. And in what has been a recurring theme in this conversation, we have to be ready for a couple of months, a couple of years, you know, 5 years, whatever, of some turbulence and some problems. And then over time, these things tend to smooth out more. I mean, there's no reason that farming should be the sort of like boom or bust business that it was in the 19th century. We have futures contracts now. We have digital inventories. We have all the tools in the world that we can do that. But what we've got to do is we've got to remove government fetters. We've got to be able to say, yes, there's a certain size business in farming that probably can't survive if we're competing on a global basis. And that might mean more concentration. That might mean less farmers in a certain area. Might mean we grow only, say, wheat, or we grow only soy. We buy, you know, rye from another nation, whatever. We got to be willing to basically live with the consequences of a less manipulated marketplace, this particular good and overall.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. When people hear some of this, particularly from someone like me, who's a right-wing nut job, they hear that I don't want any regulation, that we should have the Wild West, you know, rivers on fire and air so filthy like it is in Beijing that people can't walk around without masks on. And I don't want any of that. I believe it to being a good steward of the planet that God gave us. The base word of conservative is to conserve, and I believe all of that. And mine and Dee Dee's lifestyle goes with that. But what we have is we have overactive agencies like the EPA, as an example, that the Supreme Court held a couple of years ago in West Virginia et al., that was acting as judge, jury, and executioner without specific authority from Congress. And so that's where we're at today. It's not that we don't want regulation. We all have to have rules. We have to
with
have stop
limitations.
Signs. Yeah, we have to have stop signs. We have to have traffic lights. We have to have speed limits. Yeah. That's what we've kind of agreed to have an orderly and safe society. What we don't need is a stop sign every 5 feet. And it's in effect, that's what regulation, over-regulation has done, is to create a stop sign every 5 feet. So that a semi hauling goods can never get momentum and get on the road and go. We just over-regulate everything because these people do this, I believe, to justify their existence.
That's exactly
what it
is. But
it's not the
purpose,
for example, of the Commerce Department or the Commerce Clause. It was not to over-regulate. It was to be able to have some common sense rules that we all play by.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you mentioned this Wickard case before, and I mean, I understand this idea that, you know, the government said if you grow your own, you know, you're going to undercut the market. I mean, whatever happened to private property rights, right? I mean, is that should have been to me the first and the last argument there.
Right. I think John Locke talked about it in 1632. I could be wrong about the year, but John Locke waxed poetic about this, about the fact that men create governments to protect personal property rights, chief among that. And, you know, our government doesn't respect it. You know, we talked about it yesterday. You get a spring rain, then suddenly somebody from the DEP or the EPA comes out and says you have a vernal pool. Then suddenly you have 250-foot setbacks. Yet, magically, you know what they don't do when they take away your right to enjoy your property as you see fit? They don't reduce your property tax. It's very bizarre. It's dishonest and should be illegal.
It's a land grab is what it boils down to.
Yeah, exactly. So, again, we should all have rules. I like chess. I'm a decent chess player, and we all have rules. We know the king moves at one spot at a time. We know that the rooks can move in a straight line. They can't go diagonal. We know that the bishops can move diagonally, and the queen can do as she damn well pleases. We all know what the rules of chess are, and we all know that pawns are expendable.
Yeah.
And many of us become expendable pawns.
That's the way they look at us, right? They look at that we're in.
So, but we have. My point was, chess has rules, and if you play chess, you know the rules, and you play by the rules. So we should have rules. I have no problem with rules. What I don't want to do is take away the queen's ability to move and do what she doggone well pleases because she's really important on the chessboard.
Amen.
Absolutely.
We got to run, Doc. It's always great to have you on. Congratulations on your promotion. Well deserved. And
congrats, Peter.
You know, the other
thanks
thing,
very much.
You know, the other thing is we're just grateful you're here. You know, I mean, this is just a little show in Portland, Maine. You know, I mean, you're worthy of much bigger.
Well, I appreciate that, but I mean, I like I've said many times, this is my favorite gig of the week, and you know, I'm happy to be on. I always appreciate it.
Well, we're grateful for it. As we've been talking this morning, I've been getting text wanting a specific date when you're coming up in September. People are very eager to meet you.
Okay, I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, we'll get that worked out.
Just
for the audience, so everybody knows, we're going to do something at DeMillo's. We haven't figured out how many people yet, or we haven't figured out the logistics, but we're going to do something with the doc at DeMillo's, and I don't know what that will be. But so everybody hold tight. If you really do want to meet Dr. Peter Earle, today people have been texting. I bet we've gotten 100 texts about when are you going to be here and how will they meet you. So, and you should bring up some of your books on gold, because there's a lot of people interested in gold these days.
Absolutely. I'll do that.
All right. We'll talk with you soon, Doc. Congratulations.
All right. Have a great week, everyone. Take care.
You as well. State Representative Barbara Backshaw is going to join us at the top of the hour. Matt Jacobson, David Jones, and Dee Dee Richardson in the house.
We fix people by fixing their car. I like being part of that.
It's a great feeling knowing that you've done something that looks good and you know the customer is going to be happy with.
We're doing great. I love my job. I love what I do.